I'm Mangal Goswami, Executive Director at the Season Center. I'm going to be talking to Governor Mark Goodmanson, a well-known figure in international policy circles, as he served as the Governor of Central Bank of Iceland for 10 years, taking the helm in August 2009 as the spectacular financial crisis was raging. Iceland was one of the first in the path of the financial tsunami that followed the collapse of Lehman Brothers in August 2008. The unsustainable boom during 2005 to 2007 led to a spectacular bust with a deep recession in 2008 and 9. But the stabilization program and broader reforms ultimately ushered a sustained recovery with balanced growth. Much has been written about this. It is a fascinating story. We at the Season Center have been very fortunate to have spent quite a bit of quality time with Governor Marr during his stint as a visiting scholar, learning about how policymakers deal with such financial crises, and even on a more personal note, how to build resilience despite adversity. Governor Marr, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Mankar, and thank you for your kind introduction. Now, you ask about how I felt when I went to Iceland in the middle of 2009. Of course, I am saying this retrospectively, digging into my memory. But at the time, I knew that it was going to be a challenge, and both mentally and physically demanding. But in some sense, I had to offer my services. It was impossible to let it pass, because I thought that if I had not done it, I would have been saying to myself for the rest of my life, what if I had done it? So it is better to do it. Now, at that time, Iceland was in the middle of its deepest recession since the First World War. It was on an IMF program, but the three main goals of the program were exchange rate stability, fiscal sustainability, and financial sector reconstructions. And these were all up in the air at this point, because the exchange rate was still falling. There was a 10% GDP deficit on the public sector, and the future viability of the new banks was highly uncertain. They hadn't been fully recapitalized, and we didn't know what was going to happen to the asset values that they held. Furthermore, the IMF program itself, the review of the program was at that point held up due to the bilateral dispute with the British government over deposit insurance. So indeed, it didn't look too good. But I was always convinced that Iceland would recover. We have to remember and bear in mind that the recession was almost inevitable. As the crisis hit overgrown sectors like finance and construction, and domestic demand had to adjust to lower national income, as the big current account deficit was unsustainable. But many of the underlying fundamentals of the economy, like natural resources and energy and fish, and just like the technological sophistication of both Icelandic businesses and society at large, and the educated labor force, these were all intact. So I was convinced that Iceland would recover, but I was worried about two things. First, that the Icelandic economy would be in balance once it reached full employment. That at that point, the old tendencies for instability, like high inflation and unsustainable current account deficits, would resurface. And the second thing that I worried about was that the new financial sector would, in some sense, prove unstable, not robust enough, and that the new framework of financial stability would not be robust enough for the long run. So I at that point, I resolved to mobilize my colleagues at the central bank and other parts of the policymaking apparatus to avoid this. And I think now, in retrospect, we were successful, at least so far. But having said this, I have to admit that it turned out to be more difficult and take longer than I expected in the summer of 2009.
It's indeed quite a humbling experience, I'm sure, for you when you entered this crisis as the governor. You mentioned that, you know, you were quite positive about the recovery, but going into this, you know, the country was gripped in the depths of recession, and, you know, things were probably not as good as one would expect. At what point in time did you feel, or did you at all feel, that this was going to actually continue to amplify and create even a greater destruction of assets and capital in the economy? But of course, as you said, you saw the recovery coming at some point. But initially, could you just tell us a little bit about, you know, within the crisis, when you're within the crisis, what are some of the sort of features that you observed that were striking to you at that point? And then we can talk a little bit about, you know, the key sort of ingredients to the recovery.
Of course, I will have to paint with a broad brush because this is a long and complex story. And there's a lot of things that have been written about the build-up and the crisis itself. And I just refer the audience to that literature on the crisis, and including my own written speeches as governor on these issues that can, for instance, be found on the BIS website. Now, in terms of the crisis, I have always underlined that it was composed of two interrelated parts, but they were different parts. One was this rise and fall of cross-border banks on the basis of EU legislation, what we call the European passport for banks. And the other one was a kind of a macroeconomic boom bust cycle that was fueled by capital flows, which is something that we have seen before in many countries in the past, but whereas the first part was something new, because this was the first banking crisis in Europe after the single market was born. Now, underlying both of these parts was the global situation of ample liquidity and easy access to cheap credit. And in Iceland's case, sizable currency and maturity mismatches in bank and non-bank private sector balance sheets were a key part of this vicious amplification process that started to work when the tide turned. But at this point, both the banks and the macroeconomy were completely unsustainable. And they were in an unsustainable situation as soon as the capital stopped flowing in, because you needed this capital flow to finance the current account deficit, and you needed the banks to have access to foreign credit to roll over their short-term debt. And remember, the current account deficit was in double digits during the last few years before the crisis, so there was a big gap that was needed to finance. And when these capital inflows stopped, there was certainly a currency crisis in early 2008, and the current account deficit started to swing into surplus and came into full significant surplus in 2009. On the banking side, we have to remember these were very big banks, but they were to a very significant degree offshore, if you like. They're cross-border banks, but they were also offshore because two-thirds to three-fourths of assets and liabilities of these banks were in foreign currency, with, of course, a significant maturity mismatch between assets and liabilities that banks usually have. And when they were no longer able to roll over these short-term foreign debt, then they were dead. and the amounts involved were too big for the central bank to act as a central large resort in FX with its own FX reserves and other sources of FX like FX swaps with big central banks are not forthcoming. Now the banks might have died anyhow, but this certainly did them in. Now, when I came to Iceland in the middle of 2009, then I knew that the process of rebalancing of the economy had to run its course for a sustainable recovery. And that adjustment was bound to be associated with a recession. So in some sense, the recession, particularly in 2009, was unavoidable. And then in addition, what I also knew that the collapse of the banks did not only fall on Iceland, the cost of that collapse did not only fall on Iceland, as these were really, as I said, significant degree offs for the banks with both financing and assets abroad. And then the deposit preference that had been introduced in October 2008, just before the banks collapsed and before my arrival in Iceland, also helped to tilt the cost away from ordinary domestic residents. So the numbers look horrific, but on the ground, especially in retrospect, it was not as bad as it seemed. And probably for all these reasons, I cannot remember feeling that there would be no bottom to the decline. Mm-hmm. So everything was hopeless. And I think it also helped that I didn't have much time to do so. I came in the middle of 2009, and by the middle of 2010, we were seeing the signs of stabilization and incipient recovery. So though we knew by then that the bottom had been reached.
You indeed mentioned that, you know, that this was a very complex case because in an usual sense, when you have an adjustment of a small open economy, the real effective exchange rate depreciation or the exchange rate adjustment can sort of do part of the job of sort of making up for the aggregate demand from the private sector sort of falling. But in the case of Iceland, given the balance sheet exposures of FX mismatches of the private sector, it seemed this was even more complex, I guess. And that's where you talk about the balance sheet part, restructuring part of the economy, and the real economy part, I guess.
Absolutely. And for that reason, the initial effect of the real depreciation was contractionary. Mm-hmm. And what also is important to bear in mind in Iceland's case, that the reaction of exports to changes in the real exchange rate is rather delayed because you very quickly hit capacity constraints in the fishing industry, in the aluminium industry, and it takes time to work its magic. It did it in the end, but it took several many years. And in the interim, it was imperative to stop the over reaction of the exchange rate that shot under the equilibrium very significantly.
So at the initial stages, would you say that, you know, shepherding this stabilization of the economy was driven partly by sort of a fiscal impulse and at the same time sort of looking at the bigger picture of the restructuring so that the banks could get back to their feet again to lend to the economy? And of course, with a significant adjustment of their balance sheet being more domestically oriented rather than being so much so exposed externally.
Yes, to a degree, but we have to remember that the new banks had been carved out of the old banks, and they were not doing much lending, not because there was a credit crunch or they couldn't lend, mm-hmm. there was simply a lack of demand at that point. So as always happens in the midst of a crisis, and their task was more to restructure the debt or the loan book and promote a recovery of their asset values over time. And that they succeeded in because the economy recovered. And in terms of the kind of the ingredients of the stabilization program, there are several aspects to it, and the most important one to begin with that created the framework for the whole thing was the economic program with the IMF mm-hmm. that was approved in November 2008. And it was a very big program. The financing part was relatively big compared to the size of the economy and compared to other programs. And that in itself helped to promote confidence by boosting foreign exchange reserves, but never a single dollar was never spent. So it was never used. And but the policy framework was therefore more important. And these three goals were key to our success. And that was exchange rate stabilization, fiscal sustainability, and this financial sector reconstruction. It was up in the air in the middle of 2009, but in the end, we were able to deliver on all of these. To begin with, a key aspect of this program was these comprehensive capital controls that were introduced, proposed by the IMF. And the rationale for that was based on the existence of big direct and indirect krona positions. In retrospect, something like 65% of GDP, that would have created a new currency crisis if they had a free exit once the foreign exchange market was restarted in late 2008. And that would have created a new currency crisis and would have been devastating because of these big private sector currency mismatches. But these controls, they created space for monetary policy to focus on domestic objectives. We were able to have lower interest rates than otherwise because we didn't need to use the policy rate to defend the currency. It also created space for cleaning up of domestic balance sheets of households and corporates and thus and indirectly of the banks through that process. And then they facilitated the domestic financing of the fiscal deficit because the sovereign was not tapping international capital market, but it had a very significant deficit that needed to be financed, especially in 2009. But the problem was that these were not functioning properly, and when the IRA arrived in Iceland, the exchange rate was still falling. We fixed that with new regulations in October 2009 that closed the loopholes between onshore and offshore markets. And then the exchange rate stabilized towards the end of 2009 and then started to appreciate. And then during 2010-12, we improved enforcement, which was creating leakages as well. And very crucially, we included the failed banks behind the capital controls in March 2012. That was very important for what happened later when we were able to unwind the estates of the old banks without creating a new balance of payment crisis and hurting financial stability. And so this was a very important part of the first step to kind of make these things work, and we did. And when that started to work, then the inflation started to come down because the currencies are stabilized and appreciating in 2010. And with that, we were able to cut policy rate very significantly, and that helped with, of course, the debt crisis, etc. And then later on in 2012, we were able to bring inflation expectations as well down to target and keep it there in the following years without employment cuts. So we delivered on monetary policy, but there were two other policies that were very important in all this. where the central bank was more in an advisory role, and one was fiscal consolidation, because the fiscal deficit was eliminated over 2010 to 2014, but automatic stabilizers were allowed to work in 2009, which I think was a very important part of the design of all of this, because it meant that we were able to do this without hurting the recovery. And so that worked very well. And the second one was private sector debt restructuring, because the private sector was very indebted. A significant part of that would never be paid. And then you had this foreign currency debt and all of this, and you needed to clean up these balance sheets for growth to take off, because very indebted households and corporates, they are not doing very much. And this was a process of a market process through bankruptcies, bank workouts, but also some court decisions and various government programs. And I think this also worked reasonably well, although the overall assessment has not taken place.
So I guess, as you mentioned, the IMF program sort of pivoted along the lines of the fiscal and including debt restructuring as well as capital controls, sort of provided you some breathing room to restructure the economy and to provide monetary policy the ammunition to be able to keep interest rates at a relatively low to bring aggregate demand up over time. That, as you mentioned, was one of the key ingredients. And on top of that, I think it appears that there was very strong ownership of the IMF program by the authorities, which really instilled confidence in the investors in Iceland, I would say. How would you sort of characterize that?
I think that is absolutely correct, and I have not much to add to that. I mean, but also in addition, the strong ownership meant that those that had to carry out the program, that is to say the outstanding authorities themselves, they were convinced about what needed to be done, and of course adjusting that always when you were going along, and therefore the delivery on the goals of the program were much better than when you don't have that ownership.
So was there a moment then that you sort of started to see that the light at the end of the tunnel, if you can take us back again to those moments and say, well, you could sort of feel somewhat confident that the things may be coming back and bottoming out. Was there sort of signs?
Yes, there were signs. And I think we started to see these signs more and more clearly in the second half of 2010. And especially going into 2011. So by the middle of 2010, we knew then that we had a significant current account surplus. And that was helping, of course, to stabilize the economy and was part of the rebalancing. And we had seen the exchange rate stabilize, inflation fall. And we knew by that time that weak growth had begun in the second quarter of 2010, and then it later gathered momentum. Actually, the Central Bank of Iceland predicted that in the autumn of 2009. And when I told the media that the growth would resume in the second quarter of 2010, they thought I was a little bit crazy and were much more pessimistic. It's usually the case that central bankers are pessimistic when other parts of the economy are optimistic, and optimistic when others are pessimistic, because the psychology always tends to lag the cycle. Mm-hmm. And then the sovereign tapped international capital markets in 2011 and proved market access. And then we finished the IMF program in August 2011. And later on, we repaid all the financing before time. And it was at that point where we started to to focus on other things, we started to turn our attention to designing ways to lift capital controls without putting financial stability at risk on without creating major legal repercussions. And that is a big, big history that sometimes has to be written down and would take very long to go into here. But in the end, we were successful in doing that in 2015 to 17. So late 2010, early 2011, we were beginning to feel much better.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned that the returning to the capital market sort of heralded in a way that Iceland had recovered and it was on its way to more sustainable growth, provided many of the reforms were being implemented as you mentioned that the private sector debt restructuring and the likes. So Governor Marr, one of the things that we struggle with in Asia is taking on, there are several small open financially integrated economies like Iceland in Asia, and I think it would be great to sort of tease out some of these lessons from Iceland that we can take for broader sort of lessons for our the CSUN economy, member economy, small open member economies. What kind of lessons do you think, what kind of challenges do you think these small open economies face in general? And what kind of policy lessons do you think we can draw from the Iceland experience? Some general principles, more specific ones we can go into, but maybe at first I give the floor back to you to talk about sort of the challenges small economies face.
Yes, this is something that I've been thinking a lot about in recent years, so to speak. And I have written myself about challenges that these small open and financially integrated economies that I call SOFIs face, of course motivated by the Icelandic experience in thinking about that, but then also I had been doing work on this when I was the deputy head of the Monetary and Economic Department of the BIS, where I was more looking at the small open advanced financially integrated economies and how their monetary scope for interest rate policy and monetary independence was clearly getting less and less, and the implications of that. So I think what we are seeing from both these experiences and a lot of recent research, that it is becoming clearer and clearer that it is very difficult and probably impossible for these economies to reach both monetary and financial stability if we restrict ourselves to the instruments that were in kind of fashion before the financial crisis. And we drew that lesson from our experience that these frameworks for monetary and financial stability that were mostly in fashion before the crisis, they were inadequate, to say the least. And that these were based on an oversimplification that led to the conclusion that monetary policy focusing on inflation using interest rate only as an instrument and good microprudential regulation and supervision was sufficient for monetary and financial stability as markets would sort out the rest, especially if you had a flexible exchange rates. And this was, I think, wrong. And furthermore, all these risks that these countries faced because of large volatile capital flows, they were highly underrated. So based on these this premise, so to speak, we introduced significant reforms in Iceland after the crisis, which were reforms to the framework for monetary policy and financial stability. And it included first what I have called and we called inflation targeting plus for monetary policy, plus meaning more instruments using not only the interest rate, but also FX interventions, maybe a longer horizon for the inflation target, and maybe instruments like capital flow management tools, etc., and a better integration of monetary policy with financial stability and financial and fiscal policy. And in the financial stability field, there has been much more focus on systemic risks and introduction of macro-prudential instruments. We more or less eliminated currency mismatches in the private sector through regulation, which is very important because then this negative amplification processes that you have when you have a flexible exchange rate in these small economies, they are much reduced. We have a much tighter regulation of FX risk in the banks because that was part of the process problem that they had a huge maturity mismatch in FX. That is no longer possible because we introduce a net stable funding ratio in foreign currency. So it will be impossible for the Icelandic Bank to build such big balance sheets as they did, denominated in foreign currency. They will have to put it all into subsidiaries if they do that. And then that is no longer our risk, so to speak. It's somebody else's risk. And also, very importantly, we built buffers and increased the resilience of the system through the accumulation of foreign exchange reserves. Our reserves were completely inadequate going into the crisis, but now they are much bigger. And given that we reduced the FX risk, they are more than adequate. And we had stronger capital and liquidity requirements of banks. And finally, we introduced this capital flow management tool in 2016 to deal with excessive and initially reversible capital inflows. It was in the form of special reserve requirement. It is not active now, but the tool is there and can be quickly be used if needed. So, and then the institutional framework was also reformed to better facilitate this process because you needed more integration of financial stability work and monetary policy. And that was done up to a point in 2014, but from the beginning of this year, the financial supervisor was merged into the central bank. That has now three policy committees taking decisions on monetary policy, financial stability, and financial supervision. So that is, of course, a reflection of this new understanding. Now, whether that is suitable for all countries is a different story. I'm not going to make a judgment on that, but this is, of course, very similar to the British and Irish models. And I think that Iceland is in no way special in this regard. It is difficult for SOFIs to preserve this steeper preserve stability if you restrict the instruments too much. And it is not sufficient to put your house in order with these instruments. We need more instruments to deal with these difficult trade-offs that these countries can face. Sometimes you run almost out of instruments, and so it doesn't make sense to put artificial limits on your instruments. Now, with more instruments, you need a much more holistic analysis of the situation, and it becomes more complex. It's more, in some sense, more difficult, but that is just life. And because of this, we need what I call an integrated policy framework, where the benefits and cost of using different instruments is assessed on an equal and balanced manner. And that is, of course, the task that lies ahead of us. Both, you mean the countries, the season countries are thinking about this a lot, and we have been thinking about it, and the IMF is thinking about it, and hopefully we will make a lot of progress in this area in the years to come. But it is very clear that we need we needed to step back from the framework that we have before the crisis.
Thank you, Governor. You in your various speeches you've made and presentations, and you've underscored this fact that, you know, when you are sitting there as a governor, you know, you are facing these volatile capital flows, and you know, you see that long-term rates, or in general policy rates, are not only determined by domestic factors but by global factors. It is a much more difficult and challenging task for a governor and his staff or her staff to manage this. And you need to be more practical, and sometimes in these moments, being orthodoxical is not really the way to go. And having more practical sort of approach to this is probably the way, as you mentioned, that, you know, a more holistic and flexible framework of monetary policy with foreign exchange intervention, macroprudential policy, and possibly capital flow management policies may be what is needed for small open economies. So that's very well put. And I think for many of our seasoned member countries, small open economies, that is the challenge that on an everyday basis that we face. Even as recently as this current event that has happened, there has been a massive outflow of capital, putting significant pressure on exchange rates. And of course, interest rates as well. So your point is very, very well taken. So maybe at this point, we can move into our current situation, and, you know, the relevance of the current situation of the global health crisis, and sort of draw some lessons. If you think, you know, it's a crisis of epic proportions, and I'm sure all the playbooks are not going to be enough to deal with this crisis. But that said, what do you think are some of the central bank policy responses under current situation versus the GFC? You know, how do you look at this policy response? Do you think much has been done? Are there lessons from the financial crisis that we can benefit now, given the current situation?
Yes, I think that I think in some sense what we did during the Great Financial Crisis. So I'm then talking about the central banks around the world, which basically was introducing a lot of new instruments. That is serving us well at this point. And also what is serving us well is that we have built more buffers. Our systems are more resilient, maybe not sufficiently enough in all places. But if I look at several small open and financially integrated economies, they have, in more cases, high-level reserves, foreign exchange reserves. Banks are better capitalized. So we can use these buffers now. And the instruments that were developed before the crisis, during and after the crisis, are much more rapidly deployed this time than then, because they are in the manual, so to speak, and that is also very, very helpful. But having said that, I think that we need to acknowledge that the nature of this shock is very different from the situation that we faced during the GFC, because then the shock came from within the financial sector. And it was kind of an endogenous risk created in the financial sector and in the interaction between the financial sector and the real sector that was driving the process. But we cannot blame the financial sector for viruses traveling from animals to humans through some food markets and such like. So this is much more like an exogenous shock on mega proportions, and it's directly to the real sector. Of course, it is created not only by the health situation itself, but also by the what seems to me to be in many mostly correct responses of governments to that shock, and hopefully that is temporary. But we do not. But the implication of this is that the role of central banks is somewhat different, because central banks, obviously, because this was coming from the financial sector, it was traditional run on financial sector balance sheets, and we know what to do in that kind of a situation, and that was done in most cases. Central banks were in the front line, so to speak, and rightly so. It went even too far, and people were talking about central banks being the only game in town, etc. That was not good, and governments needed to do more, especially in terms of structural reforms, and enough wasn't done in that area. But now it is quite obvious that governments have to be in the driving seat, because this is a question of health policy. It is a question of targeted assistance to those sectors that are mostly affected. It is not necessarily always across the board, like when you have a kind of a financial shock and shock to all forms of aggregate demand. But central banks have a role to play, of course, because there might be secondary effects and significant risk created for the financial sector, and they have to provide liquidity, and they have done that on a massive scale. And so I don't think there is anything to criticize there, at not least in terms of them having not done enough. Both to create the conditions for rightly so, and I don't think they can be criticized for doing too little there. But that, to my mind, is more to make markets function orderly and facilitate that the banks play their role in terms of credit intermediation and such like. But at this point in time, where you are facing all these restrictions, you are not able to stimulate aggregate demand very much by monetary policy. It's like pushing on a string. And so it is more an issue of when we start to go out of these restrictions, where to have good conditions for recovery to take hold. And it might be very difficult, because it takes time to build confidence, and there is the issue whether the shock has fully materialized. It is still working its way through the world, and it might be staggered, the virus might come back, and all the rest of it. But the second point that I was going to make is that what we did after the crisis in terms of reforms to regulations, introduction of countercyclical capital buffers, higher liquidity and capital requirements, and now serving us very well, because the banks are much more resilient, and furthermore, we can now release these buffers. And that is, for instance, in terms of the countercyclical capital buffers, what was done in the UK and has also been done in Iceland, that we have built up these buffers, and we are very glad that we did, because now you can provide additional stimulus and support lending by reducing them down to zero again. And I think that overall, we are better prepared to deal with this because of all these policy reforms that we have talked about, more instruments. The situation is even getting more and more complex. So restricting artificially instrument set doesn't make any sense. And also because of the building of resilience and accumulation of buffers. So that lesson comes from the financial crisis, and it's serving us well.
So as you say that, clearly this is, once the health crisis is arrested and aggregate demand, people's confidence returns, and aggregate demand can be stimulated through more fiscal as well as this is the time when the banks can actually step up and say that, you know, we are going to deliver, given that we have built buffers, liquidity, and and capital buffers, this would be the time that they should be at the point where confidence returns, that they can again relend to the economy to get the economy going. Governor Ma, thank you very much for sharing your experience and wisdom with us. I'm very much looking forward to reading your book on Iceland, which I gather you're working on now. We hope to see you back at the center sometime in the near future when things normalize with this health crisis. Until then, please stay safe. Look forward to seeing you then. Bye-bye.